The XX Gab Fest is sponsored by Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio information and entertainment. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want. Get a free book when you sign up for a 30-day free trial at audiblepodcast.com/XX. The following podcast contains explicit language.
Welcome to the XX Gab Fest for Thursday, April 17th, the Friends Every Night edition. I'm June Thomas, editor of Outward, Slate's LGBTQ section, and I'm sitting in the hosting chair this week while Hannah Rosen is on spring break. Though, hopefully not sprang bright forever. We're all in the New York office today. The other two people sitting in this room with me being Slate senior editor Jessica Winter. Hi, Jessica.
Hello.
And Noreen Malone of New York Magazine. Hello, Noreen.
Hello.
Before we get started, I just want to remind listeners that, as Hannah has mentioned several times, we now have an email address where you can send comments, questions, and expressions of outrage. That address is xxgabfest@slate.com. We got some great letters after the last show, with a lot of people responding to our discussion of affairs, a term which many people pointed out can mean different things to different people. One listener, Mary, said we didn't spend enough time considering sex and noting that it can become boring to have sex with one person for years and years and years on end. Possibly.
I think that was unspoken in our discussion.
Yeah, it may have been implied. And another, Rachel, said that what she fears most about cheating isn't being caught or breaking the rules. It's the potential pain that falling in love with someone who isn't her life partner or co-parent would cause. And that, of course, is also a very good point and makes me a little bit sad and gives me some pain as well. Anyway, thanks to everyone who wrote in. Please do let us know what you think of the show. And that address again is xxgabfest@slate.com. All right. Our topics for today are, first, the confidence gap between men and women. A new book says genetics, hormones, and possibly even a failure to play sports in high school explain why men think they're so great and women doubt themselves. Second, we'll look at new statistics about stay-at-home mothers. There are more of them, and they're not necessarily out of the workforce by choice. And finally, we'll be talking about basic bitches. What is a basic bitch? And is the concept anything more than an elitist, classist, possibly even misogynist construct? But before then, our first topic is women's lack of confidence. A new book by journalists Claire Shipman and Katty Kay, which is summarised in a long piece they wrote for this month's Atlantic, focuses on the profound confidence gap between men and women. At work and at school, men display far more confidence than women. Women don't seek promotion or pay raises, and they don't speak in meetings with the same conviction that men do, which means they often don't get promotions or pay raises or plum assignments. Shipman and Kay offer a few suggested explanations, from hormones to genetics to the way we're treated in the first years of elementary school. Jessica, what did you make of their piece in The Atlantic?
I thought it was very well-meaning. I thought it was interesting. I thought it was most intriguing when it actually cited empirical data. There was a study from the UK saying that half the female managers reported self-doubt as compared to less than one-third of the male managers. Women consistently underrate themselves on questionnaires. Women at Hewlett-Packard put themselves up for a promotion only when they perceived that they met 100% of the listed qualifications. Men had no such qualms. I thought it was less strong when it went anecdotal, which was a lot of the time, when it was quoting, you know, a WNBA player here, yes, or a tech entrepreneur there, or Sheryl Sandberg there. That was less convincing to me. And I guess this might be a personal thing, but I'm always a little knee-jerk skeptical of those pieces that say, in effect, men are like this and women are like this. I understand that generalizations can be useful in terms of crafting a polemic, but, you know, the whole point of feminism, or one of the whole points of feminism, is the right not to be generalized about just because you have lady parts. And I felt like there was a lot of lady part generalization going on.
Yeah. And it also seemed like they lent on some science that always makes me a little bit nervous. You know, what the amygdala does this, and the, you know, the worrywart center of the brain.
I very much
doubt the existence of a worrywart center of the brain.
fMRI imaging to explain how we behave had gone out of fashion. Maybe I'm wrong about that. Maybe the curve has come around.
I don't even know what fMRI imaging is, but that must mean it's really out of fashion.
It although at the same time, I don't know about you, Noreen, but there's something about all of this talk. I mean, as much as I kind of look at those studies and think, oh, I don't know about the brain stuff, but I kind of recognize a lot of these things that they talk about, you know, that the feelings of self-doubt, especially, you know, I mean, we've known this since the 80s. There was that book, The Cinderella Complex, at the beginning of the 1980s that... And I think, again, we still have this thing where women kind of read these anecdotes and think, well, yeah, I can kind of relate to that.
Yeah, I recognized a certain amount in that, some of it about myself, some of it about friends. The phrase, you know, the imposter syndrome, which Sheryl Sandberg has recently sort of popularized, the feeling that apparently a lot of powerful people have that, you know, people are going to find them out and they're, you know, they got to this position incorrectly. I think a lot of people have that. I also do. There's a whole long section in which the authors describe, you know, a woman and a man in the office, and the woman is super hardworking, you know, sort of backbone of the place. And then there's a guy who 2 weeks into the job starts, you know, dropping by, suggesting things to the boss that they could do. He maybe doesn't work as hard, but he's like visible and it works for him. I wish this were not a gender stereotype that I had observed as being true, but I think in every job that I've had, that has been the case. And when people talk about how women, you know, are ahead in college and then fall behind in the workforce, this, at least in my very admittedly anecdotal observations, this is why it is, because it's the same thing that made men, some men, maybe like not read their work. Read the books in college is the same thing that's getting them ahead in the workforce.
I think that's interesting and probably true, but it also, don't you think it sort of imagines the manager as this passive receptacle of other people's self-presentation and behavior? Like, the manager is simply someone who's acted upon. Like, it's somehow not up to the manager to notice that while Jack is always in her office shooting the breeze, you know, Jamie is the one out there with her head down getting all the work done. And somehow, you know, there's this irresistible tie that I'm born along that, you know, I have to give Jack the promotion over Janie because he's such a go-getter. It's interesting that you can take almost anything in this piece that's in the plus column for men and turn it around and make it a negative.
I like the way you're thinking.
Yeah. Whether it's, you know, whether it's lack of self-doubt, whether it's the fact that men put themselves up for promotions when they're not qualified, you know, you could talk about that in terms of a lack of humility or a delusion about your own abilities or whatever. There's this one point in the piece where Shipman and Kay write, MBA students are nurtured specifically to project confidence in the fashion demanded by today's business world. And later on, they talk about how, you know, this world is deeply unfair. And I feel like maybe we should stop right there, because we're not talking about the world as some kind of intractable phenomenon. We're talking about the workplace. We're talking about a social construct. And it's one that we can rethink in the same ways that we're constantly asking women to rethink how they present themselves in the workplace. I think that's what's frustrating about pieces like this one and Lean In. Whether or not they acknowledge it, the marketplace that we're in, the workplace, was set up by men to reward stereotypically male or masculine traits. And so we're trying to condition ourselves to conform to that framework rather than thinking about just dismantling the framework altogether. And that blind spot, to me, it starts to seem willful after a while.
So what you're arguing is that it's not confidence itself that women lack, it's the societally understood display of confidence or something like that, like that a woman who is confident will maybe behave in a different manner than a man who's confident, and the way a confident man behaves is more like smacks of being a go-getter more. Is that sort of what you're saying, or am I totally misreading?
No, I think that's true. I think that's definitely true. And I also think that self-doubt is an underrated virtue. Self-doubt keeps you on your toes. Self-doubt keeps you questioning your own assumptions, and it keeps you from becoming complacent. And all of those things contribute to creativity and problem solving and conflict resolution and all these skills that you need in the workplace. And somehow we've denigrated them. And I think we know why we have.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, it also seemed to me that a lot of what Shipman and Kay were saying, you know, the way they offer just a little bit in the Atlantic article, because you can tell they want to sell copies of their book so that you'll learn more about what you can do to change things. But, you know, what they're trying to do is essentially to have women behave more like stereotypical men, when maybe better for everybody involved and for companies and for the nation might be if, instead of teaching women to act more like blowhards, we taught men to work harder instead of just bullshitting, and we kind of rewarded, you know, maybe that we rewarded people who think that they need to have 100% of the qualifications before they apply for a job rather than the 60%.
Like, but you right. can learn on the job.
I mean, of course, I'm stating that position in an exaggerated manner. But I guess what I wish were more stated was that not only can women learn more from stereotypical male behavior, because I definitely think there are changes that people can make, but also that men might, you know, learn to calibrate their behavior a bit.
And we should definitely jump in just for a second to say that we are making gross generalizations
naturally
right now about men as well as women. Just a blanket caveat for the whole segment.
That's what we always do on here.
No, I'm actually talking about very specific.
We're naming names in the next segment. Okay, so the thing that I did find heartening about, I think I wasn't as upset as you guys were about this article.
I wasn't upset. But I thought it was well-meaning.
Oh,
you said that
so
twice.
Devastating.
I know it is.
Oh, sorry.
Oh, those nice girls.
You're apologizing.
They wrote a nice article. So nice.
I just apologize, just like a woman.
Okay, but the thing. Okay, so two things jumped out at me in this. One is that overconfidence is more useful than competence, which is crazy.
Crazy.
But I think like there's a way that if you have that in mind, like overconfidence is more, you know, if you're the kind of person who's inclined toward perfectionism and you hear that statistics, maybe it will push you slightly away from your perfectionism towards something that's sort of like a useful middle. And then the other thing that I thought was interesting was that we've been talking a lot about, you know, the ways people project confidence and acting confidence, but in fact humans are really good at sensing real confidence versus sort of fake confidence. And I thought that made me feel like, okay, this is fine, because if we can just like figure out how to make women, girls and women, like more confident, or like allow them to express their confidence, then we're good. You know, like it's not like you have to act confident in the manner of a frat bro in order to be accepted in the workplace. If there is a way that you can project confidence within your own, you know, sort of range of personality traits, people will pick up on that. It's literally like your body language and your voice tone that people respond to.
I did actually find that heartening, that there is this sense that confidence is contagious, mm-hmm. that if women especially are aware of these studies about things like, you know, don't give up, don't not attempt to answer a question or attempt a thing because you're not positive that you know the, try it, you know, it that's what guys do, that's what people have been doing for a long time, that's rewarded.
Mm-hmm.
So there was some sense that just being aware of these things can actually change things. At the same time, I just wish again that there was some way that instead of saying that because it is obvious when people are faking it, you have to genuinely yeah. and earnestly self-delude. I mean, because that's the thing that's why if people are both overestimating their, which apparently in these studies guys do, their confidence, their ability, their competence, and women are underestimating, but you can read it when it's false. Therefore, the way to, you know, exude confidence is to genuinely delude yourself about your competence.
So,
but that's not right.
No, okay. Here's my belief in what confidence is. It's not necessarily a belief in your own ability, although that's what it turns into. It's the learned fact that you are resilient and a problem solver. So even if you totally fuck it up, you'll be fine. So one of my other favorite things in the study was that high school sports teaches
yes.
that. And so I was a high school athlete, so I really enjoyed that. And I genuinely believe that that is like where every sort of one of my most useful adult behaviors comes from is from playing sports.
From high school sports, really?
Yeah, totally. Resilience, like hard work. I mean, I'm over-exaggerating a little bit, but I really, like, if I ever, and confidence for sure. If I ever have a daughter, like, even if she's not into sports, she's playing them. It just, no, I think it's so good for girls. I think it, like, takes them away from a lot of the bullshit that can sort of damage you in high school. And I wasn't, like, a star athlete. I just, like, being on teams, I think, is really, really good for you and builds confidence in a way that is pretty hard to tear down.
Oh, and one of the reasons they said that playing sports in high school was good for women, especially, and for guys too, was that they learn to fail. That you can't, you can't be perfect in sports. It's technically impossible, and so, you know, you just learn that it's not that big a deal. You kind of learn to fail in a way that actually is useful to people. Whereas women tend to learn because they're more developed, you know, just in their brains when they, you know, start elementary school, so they can concentrate more, and they just have better social skills earlier on that they tend to be rewarded and praised and given all of that sort of positive reinforcement for being perfect and being well behaved, and that's what they come to learn is rewarded in life, which is, you know, again, like, those aren't bad things.
No,
but they can, I guess, if you take anything too far, it can be a little destructive. Okay, so the message for everyone: put your daughters in sports and your sons. And now is the time when we thank our sponsor. This episode of the XX Gabfest is sponsored by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it easy and fast to create your own professional website, portfolio, or even online store. For a free trial and 10% off, visit squarespace.com/double and use the offer code double. I've been working on setting up a personal website using Squarespace, and the only reason it isn't live yet is that there are so many choices for layouts and templates and so on that I've been having a hard time picking one. You know, it's just like when you're in an interview and they say, "What's your flaw?" And you say, I'm just too much of a perfectionist. And it's the same thing with this Squarespace website that I'm creating. There are so many fabulous choices, I can't pick one. If you go to squarespace.com/double and just look at the templates that are available, you'll see about 25 options, all of which can be customized at every step of the way. And you can do so many things there just by dragging and dropping elements around the page that the tricky thing is figuring out when to stop tweaking. Or if you're me, whether the tab with all the articles about dentistry should come before the tab with the articles about television. That's also a tricky.
Is there a whole dentistry tab?
Oh my God, it's a crowded, crowded tab.
I can't wait till this goes live.
All right, I will inform everyone. So the designs are gorgeous, and Squarespace is very conscious of responsive design. So when you come up with a layout that looks good on your main computer screen, you can be sure that it will also be viewable and attractive on a smaller tablet or phone screen. And you can start a trial and start building your new website today with no credit card needed. When you do decide to sign up, to Squarespace, plans start at just $8 a month, and that includes a free domain name if you sign up for a year. When the time comes, be sure to use the offer code DOUBLE to get 10% off your first purchase and to support the XX Gabfest. We thank Squarespace for their support. All right, our second topic is a new report from the Pew Research Center that found that the share of women who do not work outside the home, that is, stay-at-home mothers, rose to 29% in 2012, a reversal of a long-term decline in the number of stay-at-home moms. Noreen, there were a lot of statistics in this report. Which ones stood out for you?
Well, first of all, the really dramatic change, it went from 23% of mothers stayed at home around the year 2000 to 29, which is like nearly a third of the female, you know, workforce of a certain age. That's a lot of women. So that rapid change. The other thing that stood out to me was the increased cost of childcare, which Pew is saying is probably the reason for this. So from 1980, it's risen 70% from 1985. So in 1985, it cost $87 a week to have childcare. Now it's $148. So we think of the term stay-at-home moms, and we think, oh, like, you know, fancy ladies opting out and having mommy and me playtime and, you know, that kind of thing.
Learning Japanese together.
Right. And there's, you know, there's been this like whole mommy war thing over the past, I don't know how many years, 20, where stay-at-home moms and working moms battle over like whose life is harder and whatever. And really, it's sort of an elite argument. And what in fact is happening is that there's this whole group of women, many of them the other thing that really stood out is how many of the mothers who are stay-at-home mothers are single. Mm-hmm. So it's literally not like one parent is the bread earner or one parent is staying at home. It's these women can't make enough money to take care of their kids, and it's better to get welfare. Like, that's their only option.
Yeah.
So it just – almost, it's not even the stat that stood out to me. It's the just total misnomer of the term stay-at-home mom right now. And it's become so fraught. And everyone throws it around as like almost an accusation. Like, oh, you're just a stay-at-home mom. Oh, you hate stay-at-home moms. It's like, no, these women, like a really large percentage of them now are literally just trying to feed their kids. Yeah. They're not choosing their choice.
Yeah, I was really struck by the fact that 34%, which is a little more than a third of stay-at-home moms, are living in poverty. Compared to 12% of working moms. And the way that we define poverty in this country is so extreme that means 34% of working mothers are seriously, seriously poor, and kids mm-hmm. are growing up in very poor households.
Yeah, I was really struck that fully one-fifth of stay-at-home moms are single. And there's a big difference between the married or cohabitating stay-at-home moms and the single stay-at-home moms in terms of the reasons they give for staying at home. 41% of the single stay-at-home moms say it's because they want to be home, taking care of their family and home. So that's well over half of the single stay-at-home moms who are there not out of choice, but because they're disabled or they can't find a job or they've dropped out of the workforce.
You both mentioned this, but that whole thing about the cost of childcare. I mean, I know none of us would suggest that childcare is, you know, childcare still doesn't pay enough. People who take care of children get paid a pittance. They deserve far more money for their work. But at the same time, so many women just simply, when they do the math, there's no way they can afford the childcare from the wages that they earn. And, you know, Jessica Gross wrote about this in Slate. And I've also been struck that in several pieces that she's written, you know, for example, about the way that women write a certain kind of piece. Women journalists tend to be stuck in a certain, you know, pink ghetto. And she's written pieces where she said, look, this is the kind of piece that I can do pretty easily. There are other things that I'm very interested in, but it would cost me so much, first of all, to sort of, you know, do the research, make the pitch, you know, go off and do the reporting, that it's just not worth it. That it doesn't mean that I don't want to, that it doesn't mean that there aren't certain things that I would like to find a way to do. But even a relative, you know, a privileged woman, a relatively well-off woman, you know, is going through that kind of process and making that kind of calculation. You know, what hope is there for other women, you know, who have much less flexibility in their lives and work?
Well, yeah, all of these women are making rational economic decisions in the moment, whether it's the decision not to go off for a week on a reporting trip that may or may not result in a hefty freelance fee and having to handle childcare and the expense of that and co-parenting and all the rest of it, or whether it's simply the choice whether or not to work. I mean, middle-class women have heard for a long time, and I think this is a message that's really out there, that from an economic standpoint, staying at home with the children might seem like a good short-term decision, but a bad long-term decision in terms of long-term knocks that you take on things like lifelong income, the steady progression upward of your income, your ability to re-enter the workforce, the salary level, your Social Security credits. Jess Gross has written beautifully on all those things. And so I think middle-class women know at this point that they might be skint for those years that the children before the children are in school, but that they're making a good long-term investment for their entire family precisely because you're making a long-term investment in your career. That is the precise opposite of choosing your career over your family. You are choosing your family by choosing a career. For women living near or at the poverty level or anywhere in the vicinity of the poverty level, that might not be a choice. They simply cannot do it. And it's an eminently rational economic decision for them not to do it, even though it might not seem like a good long-term decision. I thought that it was interesting that this Pew study came out at exactly the same moment that this case in Arizona that has gotten so much attention. I don't know if you guys have heard about it, but it was this mother who did not have daycare for her two children on the day of a big job interview. So she left her two children, ages 2 and 6 months, in a car and cracked the window and went in for a job interview. And she was gone for 45 minutes and she was arrested and she now faces many years in prison. On the one hand, she made an absolutely appalling decision that is extraordinarily difficult to empathize with. On the other hand, it seems like a woman like that doesn't really need retribution. She needs help. She needs a job. She needs reliable childcare. She needs a safety net beyond her car. And it is, I think, within the possibility for me to imagine that as appalling as her decision was, it was a rational economic decision in the moment that women at every different socioeconomic level are making every single day.
Well, and one, I'm going to be very hopeful here. And, you know, the study, the numbers in the study are sort of shocking. And I hope that it is shocking enough that it brings to ahead the point that these women are a significant portion of the American population. It's a growing portion of the American population. And it's, I mean, this is what people are talking about when they're talking about inequality and the systemic way that it sort of gets enacted over generation and generation and generation, which, you know, right now people, mostly on the left, but are starting to acknowledge is like a really big economic problem facing America. And if you can fix something like availability to daycare, that would make a significant, it's a 7% difference or a 6% difference, whatever difference it is for between, you know, the 23% of stay-at-home moms versus the 29% of stay-at-home moms. So maybe it's a tipping point that we've reached, or I'm being super hopeful. But, you know, in places like New York, where there's a liberal mayor, pre-K, which is not quite the same thing as daycare, but sort of on the same, you know, spectrum of policies, is what's his number one thing that he went into office trying to do. So maybe there's a point where it's just become such a large portion of the population that policymakers have to pay attention.
Would that those things correlated. I mean, we know that certain people get more attention from politicians, typically mm-hmm. People who donate money, people who are known to always vote. This always seems like such a trivial thing, but there, you know, you mentioned it earlier, the name stay-at-home mother, which is an improvement, I think we'd all agree, over, you know, the old terms housewife or homemaker. But it's, you know, it acknowledges that being at home with kids is hard work, but it...
Does it? I think it's sort of dismissive.
Do you?
I do. I mean, and I have a mom who did not work outside the home. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I don't want to use it. You know, probably fit more the image of the stereotypical stay-at-home mother, you know, who weren't near the poverty line or anything like that. But I think she was sort of offended by the term. And so I have always been a little bit prickly about it. I mean, stay at home. Like,
right.
It's like you sound like a prisoner. Although, it sounds like a command. Stay at home, mother.
This is where commas are so important. But
That was a chapter in Eats, Shoots, and Leaves.
Now, do we have any idea for a better term? Because I fear I don't.
I was trying to come up with one last night when I was prepping for the podcast, and I cannot come up with a better one. Maybe Noreen's mom could come up with one.
You could say, well, the term full-time mom is going to offend right. mothers who work outside the home because there are right. also full-time moms. I mean, it's fraught. What do we call? We call them stay-at-home dads when, you know.
Which fathers. Abbreviated to SADS.
What's the economic term? Out of the workforce. But that's like, you yeah. know.
Is women who do not work outside the home the most accurate and respectful and it's just unwieldy and that's why we don't use it?
I'm not even sure it's respectful. I don't know.
Oh, okay.
I mean, it sounds okay to me, but.
Maybe women who don't have paid work outside the home. I mean, because again, a lot of.
That's catchy.
Stay at home. Yeah, exactly. Stay at home moms, you know, because they don't have a reason not to get stuck essentially doing so much non-paid work in for their school, for the kids' schools, or, you know, for their communities, you know, some of which I'm sure they're very happy and enthusiastic to do, but not necessarily. So something about actually being paid for the work and hopefully being paid enough, although that seems rarer and rarer.
Well, maybe listeners who are mothers of all kinds can tell us what they prefer to be referred to as. Maybe it's just mother, you know?
Yeah. As we end, one thing, again, that was really striking to me was that although 7 out of 10 kids in America are being raised by moms who work outside the home, 60% of Americans said they think that kids are better off with a stay-at-home mom. And only 35% said that it's just as good to have a working parent, which means that a lot of working parents said they thought that stay-at-home moms were better for kids. Like, that just strikes me as, I don't know, either heartbreaking or contradictory or something. How does it strike you guys?
Well, isn't it true that in the Pew study, the more education you have, the more likely you are not to say that children are better off with a parent at home?
I don't recall exactly, but that would be very... I'm convinced, yes.
So that, I mean, that was, I guess, reassuring in a super elitist, snotty kind of way.
Speaking of super elitism, that takes us directly to our final topic, which is the basic bitch. It's hard to define the basic bitch, but I'll tell you what she isn't. She isn't a bad bitch, a boss bitch, or a dope bitch. She likes scented candles, scooped bagels, UGG boots, Zumba, and Sex in the City. The basic bitch was the subject of a popular College Humor video last week, and then an intensive study in New York Magazine. Noreen, who or what is a basic bitch?
Well, the history of the basic bitch, I think, takes two paths. I think it is... It has maybe only fairly recently come to the attention of the sort of white community, but in African American, you know, sort of culture and certainly rap culture, the basic bitch has been around for a while. And it seems to me that until fairly recently, the basic bitch was sort of more generically just someone who was trying to be really cool and failing, or just like someone who is not A-list. And now the basic bitch connotes a certain kind of, let's say, mall femininity.
So kind of a sweatsuit.
Pink sweatsuit.
Maybe with Juicy on the back.
Yeah, maybe with Juicy on the back. You know, this is, again, the College Humor sort of... it's people who want to be cool in a certain way. The most interesting comparison I thought the Cut article made was that, like, maybe the basic bitch is a corollary to the bro. Mm. The bro is really into performing, being just a dude hanging out with his dudes. And the basic bitch is really into, like, being a good girl, hanging out with her girls, like, going to brunch, talking about Sex and the City. However, well, I'll let you guys talk about how you responded to the basic bitch article, but I'm ready to mount a defense of the basic bitch.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Well, let's hear it.
Yeah. Well, although first I want to know, see, before you mount your rousing defense of the basic bitch, which I, you know, does seem reasonable, I'm wondering if there's any way that the basic bitch is anything other than the person who is accusing someone of being a basic bitch.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, is there anything more elitist? Is there anything more like, oh, that woman is faking it. That woman has no taste. That woman is a regular, a civilian. She's fronting, whereas I'm special.
Wait, the dialogue you just gave was like straight out of Real Housewives.
Really?
Basically. Not really, but like that's... Mm. They always are like, oh, that woman, she's, you know, I don't think they use the term basic, but they might as well.
The question is throwing the epithet of the basic bitch actually
totally
the cry
basic.
Of the basic bitch,
yeah.
That it's an expression of your fear that you yourself are a basic bitch?
Yeah. What do you think?
So it's a defense mechanism?
I think so. I don't see
it. Interesting.
I mean, to me, the idea of looking down upon others and declaring them basic is just the epitome of basicness.
Okay, that's a really good point because, okay, I was racking my brain. I wasn't sure I'd ever encountered a basic bitch in the wild.
Yeah.
I do not believe that.
No. Well, I came up with one. And so I had this terrible freelance fact-checking job at a publication that shall remain nameless. And every week we had a close, and you would always hope that you didn't get this one editor because she was so derisive and so difficult. And she dressed very J. Crew pre-Jenna Lyons. Like, imagine, like,
that is
like
an amazing burn.
Like Bucknell University sorority circa 1995. And during close, she would always watch back-to-back episodes of Friends in this little TV in her office. Like, Friends, Joey and Chandler were always, like, blaring in the background during close. And
was she drinking a pumpkin spice latte?
No, I mean, this was sort of pre-latte. She was very into her Sex in the City. But what... I think the reason my mind excavated her as my basic bitch wasn't just because she was super into Friends and dressed a certain way and spoke a certain way and got lots of blowouts. I think it was also because she was a terrible person. And so my question that maybe Noreen can address is, are the basic bitch's entertainment preferences and sartorial preferences symptomatic overall of, like, normative status quo thinking? Like, is the basic bitch the last of her group to come around on marriage equality? Is the basic bitch, like, if she finds out that, like, one of her friends doesn't wax and her boyfriend is uncircumcised or something, does she get, like, super judgy about it because she's super normative? Like, does her conventional taste, like, flag a lack of open-mindedness that is itself a character defect?
Well, I think the argument that taste equals morality is specious.
Right. Does taste correlate with character in certain ways?
This is part of my defense of the basic bitch, is that, like, I mean, sure, there are probably people who wear North Face fleeces and dislike marriage equality, but I'm not so sure those things are related. I think this is, like, pure... I would like to think that, like, calling someone basic means they are unenlightened. I mean, I think that's what it originally meant, right? Mm-hmm. That they're unenlightened, they're ambitious for the wrong things, they're sort of status seeking for the wrong things, like, not wrong things like wrong purse, but, like, wrong.
Would you like to quote Krishan there?
I think, June, I think I've heard you sing this song.
Are you referring to the lines, Gucci, Gucci, Louis, Louis, Fendi, Fendi, Prada, basic bitches wear that shit, so I don't even bother?
Yeah, I was. I want a remix of that.
I was the culture editor at Time when that song came out, and I fielded a lot of think piece pitches about Krayshawn.
I mean, so Krayshawn, we should say, in, like, 2011, 2012, she's a white rapper, and she came out with this song, which is just hypnotic and sort of brought the term basic bitches into really mainstream use. I think her understanding of it is the one that we have, sort of like the knockoff purses, the people who have, like, mall aspirational taste, is the version that we received through the Oracle Krishan, who now I'm pretty sure, like, has a baby and a baby blog. Anyway, maybe I should fact check that before saying that on the air. Yes. Oh, our producer is saying yes. Yes.
She's a mommy blogger now?
I think she's a stay-at-home mom.
She was part of that Pew study.
Yeah, exactly. That whole 6% was Krayshawn. She takes up a lot of space in the culture. Okay. So, but I think, like, so first of all, Sex in the City is a great show. We need to enter that into the discussion. It is a great show. You know, Uggs, comfortable shoes, you know?
Warm for the feet, too.
Peplum skirts, flattering on some people.
Like, who?
Me! They're flattering on me.
Okay, then.
So the thing that I think all of these things have in common really is this, they are reveling in being girly, right? Mm. In a way that, like, isn't cool right now. Like, the people I've heard throw around the term basic are, like, girls and dudes in Brooklyn who, like, are, you know, they wouldn't self-identify as hipsters because that's not cool. Mm. But, like, they are, you know, they don't like mainstream. They think that because, you know, they are more complicated than someone who is not ashamed to say Sex and the City is good. You know, like, I think it's the presumption that if your tastes are complicated, you have a complicated soul, and it's better that way. And, you know, you can, lots of people, there's also, like, the idea that, okay, if you live in, you know, Crown Heights, Brooklyn, are you basic if you wear skinny jeans and, like, you know, work for NPR? Like,
if you're white?
Yeah. Like, if you, you know, are you basic if you are normal within your context, or does basic mean, you know, pumpkin spice lattes? And
yeah. See, I think you have to be suffused with irony to even accuse of people of being basic. And I think part of that is because no one in this world self-identifies as basic.
Right.
People might like all of those things. Like, for example, even with the things that when I like popular things, like, for example, NCIS, I don't think that makes me basic. I think that makes me be on the cutting edge, because I think I'm special, and I'm always going to think I'm special, whatever it is, whether it's like my taxidermy hobby or whether it's my love of NCIS. I'm always going to be special.
Wait,
I'm never
do you
gonna...
have a taxidermy hobby?
No, okay. I do own some taxidermy items, and I'm very interested in it, but I've never actually learned to taxi. You know, is it just everybody thinks they're special? Everybody thinks they're, you know, in the 1% of interest. And it's, you know,
everyone is special. Human beings are all complicated and unbasic.
But exactly. So you're saying that no one's basic?
No one's basic, although I will say it's a really satisfying insult. Yeah. You know, it's just basic.
But also, again, it's, you know, you only want to hurl an insult if the person deserves it. And, you know, going back to my proto-basic bitch, I cannot imagine scoffing at any of the things that she loved and gave her pleasure if she wasn't, like, a horror
well,
show.
Well, so let's talk about the word bitch. Yeah. Because we've been just throwing it around, like, merrily. Like, oh, like, basic bitch. You know, that's how we call women right now. But, in fact, maybe it sounds like this woman was just a bitch in the, like, awful insult way of using that word, which, I mean, it's sort of complicated that we're all using it as just like a way to categorize women. Yeah. Bitch. You know, I don't.
Again, I think it has to be suffused with irony. Like,
yeah,
I'm saying in a very loving way, Noreen.
But Jessica's saying she didn't like this woman because she was not that nice. And it sounds like it had more to do with that than her Bucknell uniform.
Well, also, I mean, we have to look at the basic bitch in context with its opposite number, which is the bad bitch, mm-hmm. which is a compliment, mm-hmm. as I understand
sure.
it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So,
as his dope bitch,
right? So there are positive bitches as well as negative bitches. But I think Noreen's point still stands. Like, we're just sitting around calling each other bitches. Mm-hmm. Like, do we have a problem with that?
Mm, I'm not sure. I mean, I should. But I'm not sure that I do. But I do think that, like, when someone is calling someone else a basic bitch, what they're calling them, I think, is more bitch than basic. And, like, the term gives them a sort of, like, au courant, like, rap video way of being like, I don't like that girl and I don't like her because she's different than I am.
I mean, I think, too, that the New York piece, as you suggested, Noreen, like, compared the basic bitch to the bro and said that, you know, basic bitches should just, you know, own their basicness and, you know, talk about basic bitching with their basic bitches. But they're not the same. It's just,
it's a verb. It's an adverb.
It's everything. It's I'm every woman. It's all in me. But the, you know, bros, even though some people do look down on bros, like, it's not, nobody's really going to be insulted about being called bro, although I do have a friend who has a t-shirt that says don't bro me if you don't know me. So I guess, you know, maybe I'm wrong about that, but, like, you know, they're not really comparable in terms of, like, the pain that their potential to cause pain,
because it's worse to be, like, super girly in our culture, and, like, the cultural products that are, like, super girly are looked down on more than the cultural products that are super male. Again, Sex and the City, good show. You guys should re-watch that show.
Oh, I'm not arguing with you. It's
need
a good
to
show.
Watch that
You've never
show.
Watched it?
Oh, my
no.
God.
No.
I've seen the pilot. Is the pilot where Carrie tries to have sex like a man?
I forget.
Okay.
But I mean,
I've seen that one.
That sounds right. It's actually, it's like really subtle social commentary. It's not, it's really not basic. I think Girls is much more basic than Sex and the City.
Oh, you guys had prescriptions. You had assigned labels to all the girls, right?
Well, Shoshana is a stereotypical basic bitch.
Okay.
Like, you know, she, I mean, we sort of should maybe go back to this, but like, there's like a real, you said classist. I mean, there's like, she aspires to the wrong thing. She sort of, you know, wants like, you know, she wants things that are expensive for the mall, but not like truly expensive in New York City, if that makes sense. Like, that's what, that's the classist element of the basic bitch. It's like, they're middle class taste.
Right.
Like,
they're middle brow.
Yeah.
Day class.
Yeah, exactly. Mm. And then, so Jessa at least thinks of herself as a bad bitch. And
she is a bad bitch.
And Marnie, I think, is just supposed to be a bitch. I don't know how Hannah fits into that.
See, Hannah is, I guess, a hipster. I don't know. That's not quite the right.
Right, she's the one throwing around the basic bitch terminology.
But that's the thing. Like, does anyone, if we were to show Girls to, you know, far more people than have actually seen it, if as many people saw Girls as have seen NCIS, which is an awful lot of people, would,
I've never seen it.
How many would want, oh my God.
Neither have I.
So good, you guys. It's the most popular show in America.
What's it about? Well, I'll
ask
you later.
It's about the NCIS. Next question. So if a lot of people saw it on a, you know, truly wide scale, I wonder how many people would want to be each girl in the Girls. And I think a very small number would want to be Hannah, not only because she sometimes misbehaves, but just or because, you know, apparently her appearance freaks out America, but because she's a little, you know, she's harder to pin down. Like, she, it's hard to say what group she belongs to, what her tribe is. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, one of the great things about being basic is that you kind of know who your people are.
Well, I mean, I think like none of the girls on Girls are aspirational, really. You're not supposed to want to be any of them. And that is one reason I think why Sex and the City gets mocked, because people are like, I'm such a Charlotte, you know. But like, being basic, yeah, you're right, it's about belonging to a tribe and identifying as a Charlotte or a Carrie or whatever is like classification and sense of belonging. And I don't think that's a basic emotion. I mean, I think it's I think it's a basic human emotion,
right?
But I don't think it's like quote unquote basic.
I just so that I knew which tribe was which, I did a slightly stalkery thing in that I looked up my basic bitch on social media. I looked at her Twitter and Instagram feed so that we would have an accurate sociological portrait of the basic bitch circa spring 2014. So this is the basic.
I hope she's listening.
I do too.
Hey, how's it going? What's up? Okay, so this is the portrait that I put together. I'm going to submit this to Pew, actually. I think this is going to be their next study on the basic bitch. Okay, she's very into Gone Girl. Very into it.
Me too, guys. Am I a basic bitch? Is this my Twitter feed? Keep
this
going.
Is,
keep going.
The subtext of this is a Q&A with Noreen Malone. She uses the word meh a lot.
Meh.
She'll throw out an observation about something she's watched or something she's read and then say discuss, but she has like 200 followers.
that was like, so
burn.
Shady.
And like, no one ever discusses with her. It's really sad.
People who aren't journalists, Twitter is different for them.
She has a lot of 90s nostalgia. She does Soul Cycle. She still gets blowouts a lot. She uses the word biatch. That's B-E-E-Y-O-T-C-H. She has a lot of critical things to say about the appearance and comportment of young female celebrities. She tweets at celebrities. And finally, drumroll please, she watches Friends still every single night before she goes to bed.
Wait, she tweets about it?
Yeah. I got this all off Twitter and Instagram.
I think she could be a hipster. Like, just like all layer of irony. I don't know. These categories. We spend too much time categorizing each
there's
other.
There's no irony there.
Okay. Why is irony a good thing? We should all just be sweeter
and let's all promise to get in touch with our basic bitch and to watch more Friends.
If
And Sex and the City.
And Sex and the City.
You gotta watch Sex and the City. It's so good.
I'm on it.
Damn good show. Okay, let's move on to our recommendations. Jessica, what do you have?
I want to recommend a novel that came out last year that I just finished. It's called We Are All Completely Beside Ourselves by Karen Joy Fowler. It's one of those books that's really hard to talk about without giving a lot away. There's a, I wouldn't call it a twist, but there's a revelation partway through. But really broadly, it's about a family that's torn apart by the father's hubris and by a child's very understandable anger. It's about nature versus nurture. It's about identity, who you fundamentally are as opposed to how you define yourself against other people. And it's about being a lonely kid who doesn't quite fit in. It's funny and touching and shocking, and it's just about everything you want out of a novel. And again, it's called We Are All Completely Beside Ourselves.
That sounds not only great, but also like it has elements of all of our topics today, of confidence and overconfidence, of stay-at-homeness and child raising, and also basic bitchery.
That had not occurred to me, but that is all true.
I am going to recommend a great book, a bit of nonfiction. It's called Busted, A Tale of Corruption and Betrayal in the City of Brotherly Love by Wendy Ruderman and Barbara Laker. And they are reporters at the Philadelphia Daily News, which is the scrappy tabloid that is the stablemate of the more revered Philadelphia Inquirer. And Ruderman and Laker wrote a series of articles about police corruption in Philadelphia, and they eventually won a Pulitzer Prize for those pieces, and they revealed all kinds of just shady goings-on in the narcotics division of the police department. And then they wrote this book, which is the story of how they got the story, and they're very self-deprecating and charming, and it's ultimately a tale of sort of persistence and perseverance and knocking on doors and just kind of going through arrest reports and just, you know, the business of being a journalist. It's a kind of all the president's men when there's no shady guy in a basement garage, but just a lot of paperwork and knocking on doors. And it's also really great about what it's like to be a newspaper reporter when the business is falling apart. The Daily News declares bankruptcy and then gets sold from under the owner during the period that the book covers. And it's a really like zippy read. It's a lot of, it seems odd given the circumstances to say that it's a fun read, but it's just a really quick, fast, exciting read. And it's especially good if you're interested in journalism and cities and corruption. I recommend it. Busted, A Tale of Corruption and Betrayal in the City of Brotherly Love. Noreen, what do you have for us?
Well, since I'm the resident basic bitch, I'm going to recommend a really mainstream romance movie that was out 15 years ago. Ooh. That's now streaming on Netflix. I had never seen The Thomas Crown Affair until like a week or two ago.
The one with the
Pierce Brosnan.
Yes. And, oh, Rene Russo is so good in that. Oh my God. So
yeah.
Lovely.
So I'd always heard people sort of be like, oh, that movie. Like women, obviously women. I'd never heard a man be like, oh, that movie. but I'd never watched it because, it, you know, I like a little humor in my, you know, I like a little calm with my rom. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it's sort of comedically over the top. The scene where she's dancing in the see-through dress is hilarious, in fact. But really, just, you know, if you've got a Friday night in, going to have some white wine with me, put on some Uggs, cue up the Thomas Crown Affair, ladies, and call me for brunch so we can discuss.
Discuss. Okay, that's the end of our show. Thank you to Chris Wade for engineering and producing the podcast this week. We'd like to thank Andy Bowers, who's the executive producer of all the Slate podcasts and who's here in New York and came in to say hello to us before the show. Remember to send your comments to xxgabfest@slate.com. For Jessica Winter and Noreen Malone, I'm June Thomas. We'll be back with you in 2 weeks' time. Gucci, Gucci, Louis, Louis, Fendi, Fendi, Prada. The basic bitches wear that shit so I don't even bother. I put that on my partner.